Welcome to this deep dive. In this lesson, we're exploring understanding data types. If you've watched the overview, this will build on that. If not, you'll still be able to follow along. Now, let's go further by exploring practical examples, future workplace relevance, responsible use, and how you can build confidence with this skill. So, imagine a company blowing $10 million on a massive new product launch because, you know, their core spreadsheet says user engagement is up 80%.
Oh, boy.
Right. They pop the champagne. They're celebrating the metrics. But they completely ignore the thousands of unstructured user comments online screaming that the product is, like, literally catching fire and melting.
It's an absolute recipe for disaster. And, you know, your $10 million disaster scenario perfectly captures the stakes here.
Yeah, treating all data the same is just wild.
Exactly. We often operate under this really persistent misconception that data is exclusively the domain of mathematicians or maybe computer scientists sitting in a dark server room somewhere.
Right, the guys with the giant mainframes.
Yeah. But the reality of the future workplace is just very different. Whether you are a university student putting together a complex research paper, or a young professional trying to understand why a major initiative just succeeded or failed, understanding data types is the bedrock of your workflow.
It really is. It's like the ultimate shortcut.
It dictates your analysis quality, your interpretation accuracy, and really the strength of your academic reasoning. Because if you don't understand the materials you're working with, you are essentially flying blind in a digital storm.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So let's ground this right away by looking at the fundamental materials we're dealing with. The lesson breaks down two massive categories, right? Quantitative and qualitative data. So the textbook definition usually says quantitative data is the numerical information we use for measurement and calculation, like the hard math.
The numbers.
Right. Exam scores, income brackets, attendance rates, website clicks. And then on the flip side, we have qualitative data, which is descriptive. It explains experiences, opinions, direct observations.
Yeah, the human element.
Exactly. Interviews, feedback, comments, you know, just the general feeling of a room.
Precisely. The simplest heuristic here is that quantitative data answers the how many or how much, while qualitative data attempts to answer the why and, you know, what was it actually like to experience this thing.
But wait, I have a question on behalf of the listener here, because isn't there a huge danger in that?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's easy to just say numbers versus words, but isn't it really about how we use them? I've been in strategic meetings where someone uses so-called qualitative data, which honestly, in reality, is just them cherry-picking two glowing quotes from a 50-page survey.
Oh, I've seen that happen.
Right. And they use it to try and save a project that the quantitative numbers clearly show is just bleeding money. So aren't words infinitely easier to manipulate than raw numbers? If we just say qualitative is the why, aren't we inviting people to basically just invent a narrative?
That is a brilliant point, and it highlights exactly why we have to move beyond just defining these terms, you know, on a whiteboard and look at how they actually behave in the wild.
Right, in real life.
Because you were talking about the tension between statistical significance and anecdotal weight. Yes, qualitative data can absolutely be weaponized if it is used in isolation to override quantitative reality.
Because words just hit harder.
They do. Words carry emotional weight, which makes a single compelling quote sometimes feel way more persuasive than a spreadsheet showing declining revenues. But the mechanism to prevent that manipulation is intentional alignment.
Okay, intentional alignment. Break that down for me.
So you don't use qualitative data to measure the scale of a problem. You use the quantitative data, the hard numbers, to establish that a problem exists across, say, 10,000 users.
Okay.
Then, and only then, do you use the qualitative data to investigate the exact friction points causing those users to leave. You need the scale of the math combined with the rich context of the words.
Okay, so qualitative gives us the why, and quantitative gives us the scale. But practically speaking, this introduces a massive logistical problem.
How so?
Well, if I have a spreadsheet of 10,000 exam scores, I can average them in, like, 1 second. But if I have 10,000 handwritten student reviews, I can't physically read them all. How do I actually extract the why at scale?
And that right there is the crisis of the modern internet, which brings us to how data is actually stored and organized.
Right.
It's the distinction between structured and unstructured data. Structured data is highly organized, usually in neat tables or relational databases.
The rows and columns.
Exactly. Structured data is like a modern supermarket. You want a Granny Smith apple. You walk into the produce section, aisle 4, bin 2.
It's all just sitting there waiting for you.
Right. It is precisely mapped, highly predictable, and instantly searchable. Your spreadsheet of 10,000 exam scores is a supermarket. Unstructured data, on the other hand, is a dense forest.
A forest, okay, I like that.
This includes everything else. Videos, massive blocks of text, images, really erratic social media posts. The apples are definitely out there in the forest, but they aren't neatly stacked in bins with price tags.
You have to go find them.
Exactly. You have to actively forage, recognize patterns, and harvest them yourself.
I love that visual.
Mm-hmm.
Because trying to manage unstructured data, like structured data, is basically, it's like walking into a messy closet or a dense forest with a label maker and getting frustrated that the trees aren't perfectly aligned in rows.
It's pointless.
Yeah. You can't just take a viral TikTok video or a rambling customer service phone call and shove it into an Excel cell. It simply doesn't compute without the right approach. So how do modern professionals actually harvest that forest?
Well, they do it by building mechanisms to structure the unstructured.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. In the past, this meant teams of humans painfully reading through thousands of reviews and manually tagging them, say, labeling a review as positive or negative.
That sounds exhausting.
It was. But today, we use sentiment analysis algorithms and natural language processing to scan that unstructured text and pull out metadata.
Wow, okay.
We essentially train systems to go into the forest, find the patterns, and bring back a map. But here is the risk, and this is why this matters to you, the listener. If you, as the professional, don't fundamentally understand that you are dealing with a forest instead of a supermarket, you'll use the wrong tools.
Right.
You'll misapply your algorithms, analyze the data poorly, and ultimately draw disastrously weak conclusions.
Which brings us to how you, listening to this right now, can actually apply these concepts when you are staring at a screen trying to make sense of a chaotic project.
Yes, let's get practical.
The lesson gives us a great checklist, but rather than just reading it as steps, let's look at it as a continuous workflow. First, you have to identify the material in front of you.
Right, diagnose it.
Yeah. Are you looking at a forest or a supermarket?
Yeah.
Is this numerical
right.
or descriptive? Second, you have to relentlessly match the specific data type to the question you're actually trying to answer.
This is so critical.
Like, if leadership wants to know how many people attended an event, do not hand them a folder of interview transcripts.
Exactly. Don't use a hammer to drive in a screw. And the third part of that workflow is organization. You need to keep your structured databases fundamentally separate from your unstructured archives until you have a deliberate strategy for how you want to analyze them.
And the final step, which really feels like the holy grail of modern analysis, is synthesis. Combining them.
Synthesis is where the real magic happens. This is the most crucial technique. Neither quantitative nor qualitative data paints a complete picture on its own.
They need each other.
They do. Structured and unstructured data serve different but highly complementary purposes.
Let's make this incredibly concrete with a real-world case study from the lesson. There was a student research team tasked with analyzing the impact of a new campus initiative.
This is a great example.
Now, they could have easily fallen into the trap of just looking at the structured numbers, turning in a pie chart, and, you know, calling it a day. But they didn't. They combined survey statistics, our quantitative structured data, with interview feedback, our qualitative unstructured data.
Let's dissect the mechanics of why that hybrid approach was so successful for them. Imagine they only looked at the structured survey statistics.
Okay.
They might find a pristine metric indicating that 80% of participants rated the new campus portal as poor.
Yokes. Okay, 80% is bad.
Right. They have an undeniable metric of failure. But if they take that to the administration, the very first question will be, well, why is it poor and what do we fix? And the students would have to say, we have no idea.
Right. They just know it's bad, not why. And conversely, if they only looked at the unstructured interview feedback, they might sit down and listen to three deeply passionate, angry rants about how the portal's login screen is super confusing.
Yeah.
But without the quantitative data, they have no idea if those three students represent a massive campus-wide usability issue or if they are just a vocal minority of three people who, like, forgot their passwords.
Precisely. By combining them, the quantitative data provided the indisputable scale of the problem, and the qualitative data pinpointed the exact mechanical failure causing it.
And bringing this back to your future career, this is exactly the friction we see in corporate environments all the time.
All the time.
You have leadership teams who only want to look at pristine, structured dashboards. They love the supermarket because it feels safe and controllable. But the actual bleeding-edge problems, the reasons a company is losing clients, are usually hidden deep in the messy, unstructured forest of customer support call transcripts and social media sentiment.
Yes, the modern digital workplace desperately needs professionals who can navigate both. Employers aren't looking for one-dimensional analysts anymore. If you walk into a meeting with only half the picture, you aren't going to survive the follow-up question.
You're
going to
get roasted.
You certainly will. The problems we are trying to solve in a digitally enabled society are rarely binary. They are nuanced, human, and complex. Therefore, your approach to understanding those problems just cannot be one-dimensional either.
This naturally leads us into a critical reflection on responsible use and data ethics. Mm. We touched on it earlier with the idea of cherry-picking quotes, but poor analysis isn't just an academic mistake where you get a B instead of an A in a paper.
It goes way beyond that.
Yeah. Misunderstanding results has severe real-world consequences. Using incorrect information or bad data synthesis can lead entire organizations astray. It can result in policies that actively harm communities or just waste massive amounts of resources.
Which is why responsible digital citizenship requires an intentional commitment to data integrity. It means you are acutely aware of your own biases and you refuse to force a narrative.
Forcing a narrative is such an important phrase. There is an old statistics joke that if you torture the data long enough, it will eventually confess to anything.
That is exactly what forcing a narrative looks like in practice. It happens when a professional decides what they want the answer to be before they even look at the information.
Right. Working backward.
Yes. And then they selectively weaponize the data types to prove their preconceived point. If the quantitative metrics clearly show a project is failing, an unethical analyst might bury the spreadsheet and heavily feature a few unstructured, positive, qualitative reviews to create an illusion of success.
Just to save face.
Exactly. Responsible use means intentionally matching data types to the problem being studied. It means letting the data speak for itself, using the right tools to listen to it accurately, rather than manipulating the formats to serve your ego. It requires a mindset of genuine curiosity and accuracy rather than a fear of making a mistake.
It fundamentally comes down to honesty in your analysis. And building the confidence to be that honest and that adaptable requires practice. Mm-hmm. So let's pivot to some practical growth advice.
Do it.
How do you actually build this analytical muscle? The lesson provides a highly actionable habit that you can start right now, which is the classification activity.
I love this activity.
It's so good. Take 10 random examples of information from your current studies, your job, or even just your digital life today. Actively categorize them. Is this piece of information quantitative or qualitative? Is it a structured supermarket or an unstructured forest?
It sounds incredibly simple, almost too simple. But doing this repeatedly trains your brain to instantly recognize the analytical constraints of the material you are holding.
Like muscle memory.
Exactly. And as you build that mental reflex, you also need to familiarize yourself with the actual digital tools required to handle these different types. Every modern professional should be exploring tools like Google Sheets and Microsoft Excel for managing their structured, quantitative data.
And then the lesson mentions Tableau Public. Now, if you haven't used Tableau before, it might sound a little intimidating, but I want to talk about how a tool like Tableau actually works because it's brilliant.
It really is.
It's not just a fancier spreadsheet. It is a tool designed to wrangle massive amounts of both structured tables and complex information into clear visual insights.
It's actually fascinating from a cognitive standpoint. When you look at a raw table of data in Excel, your brain has to read every single number sequentially to figure out what's going on.
Which takes forever.
Right. It's slow, conscious processing. Yeah. Tableau and data visualization in general leverages what cognitive psychologists call pre-attentive attributes.
Oh, what's that?
It basically uses color intensity, spatial grouping, and size to communicate volume and trends to your brain before you even consciously realize you're analyzing data. It turns the raw numbers back into a visual story.
Exactly. It translates the math into a language the human brain just instantly, intuitively grasps. But, and this is the crucial caveat, Tableau cannot fix bad data.
No, it cannot.
If you feed it a fundamentally flawed mix of quantitative and qualitative data, it will just give you a beautiful, highly colorful, pre-attentive visualization of a lie.
A very pretty lie.
Right. The tool is only as good as the human deciding what goes into it.
Which is why understanding the foundational data types is the prerequisite to using any of these advanced digital tools.
All right, as we pull all these threads together, we want to pose the lesson's core reflection prompt directly to you, the listener. How can understanding data types improve the way I analyze information and make decisions?
It truly is the ultimate question for navigating a digital future.
Think about the territory we've covered today. Do you now know what quantitative data is? Qualitative. The real difference between structured and unstructured data.
Hopefully the answers are yes.
Right. Next time you are sitting in a Tuesday morning meeting and someone hands you a pristine, perfectly structured pie chart, I want you to ask yourself, what human stories, what messy, unstructured realities were stripped away to make this chart look so neat?
That is a great question to ask.
And conversely, when someone tells you a deeply moving anecdote about a single user's experience, ask yourself, where is the scale? Where is the quantitative backing to show me this isn't just an isolated event?
If we connect all of this to your broader lifelong learning journey, the most important takeaway is that digital confidence isn't about memorizing definitions.
No, not at all.
It is entirely about adaptability. It is about having the mental agility to look at a completely unfamiliar, highly complex problem, and knowing exactly which tool and which type of data you need to pull from your digital toolkit to solve it effectively.
It's about being robust enough for whatever the digital landscape throws your way. So as you continue to navigate your digital careers, we want to encourage you to stay endlessly curious, remain rigorously responsible with the information you wield, and keep making yourself future ready.
Absolutely. And to truly lock in this new framework, we strongly encourage you to review the end of module study guide and actively complete the workbook activities. The act of applying these concepts is where temporary knowledge becomes a permanent, highly valuable professional skill.
We also want to acknowledge the excellent further reading references provided in the lesson if you are eager to expand on these ideas. That's Naked Statistics, The Art of Statistics, and Storytelling with Data. These are fantastic, highly accessible resources to keep building that analytical muscle. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure to explore this with you.
As AI gets vastly better at scraping the unstructured, messy reality of our human lives and turning it into highly structured, predictive models, the question going forward isn't just whether you know how to read the data. The real question is, do you know when the data is reading you?